Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
What happens when you die? Is it wrong to be frightened of dying? How should you live if you are 20 and will be dead by the end of the summer?
When it's finished flying, you just washed and go to the pub for a drink. Next day, you never know, you not come back.
In August, we lost 5 out of 6 in one flight. They were just suddenly attacked out of the blue by 109s and it all went down.
Inside the Battle of Britain, from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. It's the 18th of August 1940, the hardest day. On this day, the Luftwaffe tried to land a knockout blow to destroy RAF Fighter Command. Just over a month into the Battle of Britain, the Luftwaffe threw everything they could at the RAF, knowing they had to break them to be able to invade Britain. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. And in this episode, we'll find out just what it took to face the unrelenting onslaught of the German Air Force, day after day after day. Episode 2, The Hardest Day. Just a few days earlier, on the 13th of August 1940, the Germans had launched a new phase of the offensive, Operation Eagle Attack, concentrating on RAF airfields and radar stations. There was new intensity, with the Luftwaffe flying thousands of sorties across the UK in just a few days. But poor intelligence and navigational errors meant they were met with stronger resistance than they expected. On the 15th of August, the Germans suffered their worst losses to date. They called that day Schwarzer Donnerstag, or Black Thursday. The British called it the Greatest Day. Despite their losses, on the eve of the 18th of August, German intelligence suggested that the RAF was down to just 300 serviceable fighters. The Luftwaffe's plan of attack was simple. German bombers were to strike at the RAF airfields in the southeast of England, wiping out the country's air defences. But RAF Fighter Command was poised for a counterattack. This was a real escalation of the air battle. Carl Warner is the head of narrative and curatorial at the Imperial War Museum.
One of the central things that the Luftwaffe absolutely had to do if they were going to win was basically to knock the Royal Air Force out. They needed to call up these very big battles, Fighter Command in its entirety, and shoot it down. And in August, that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to take out the Royal Air Force's airfield, make it almost impossible for them to continually operate, to catch aircraft on the ground, and to shoot as many down in the air.
Large formations of enemy aircraft sighted south of Thames flying west. Close bomber formations escorted by fighters flying all over the sky.
Over the course of the day on the 18th of August, Luftwaffe aircrew threw 850 sorties in 3 major waves over Britain. And RAF pilots flew a staggering 927 sorties to fight them off. This wasn't the day that saw the most sorties of the Battle of Britain. But the loss of aircraft numbering into the 60s for both sides made it the hardest fought day, and one that showed RAF Fighter Command just what they were up against. The Battle of Britain wasn't going to be won or lost in just one day. It was going to be a grinding war of attrition.
Some people ask me, how many did you shoot down during the war? I didn't turn round to look.
the facts of life where we'd be flying many, many times during the day, having taken off in the darkness, and then as the dawn came up, we'd fly to a forward base, and then we'd be at redness all through the day, and then in the evening, just as the light was beginning to fail, we'd fly back to our base at North Weald, and then there'd be a mad rush to get down to the local tavern and before the pubs closed.
I sighted a large number of Junkers 87s in line astern, 7,000 feet, dive bombing between Hawkinge and Dover. I dived into the attack using 12 boost and fired a long burst at one from astern. It seemed to shudder in mid-air and then dived away steeply with black smoke coming from it. I saw my ammunition entering the machine.
The squadron was patrolling over Kentish coast at 26,000 feet. And above and below, swarms of 109s appeared.
So a typical day was you stay in dispersal from first thing in the morning to last thing at night because you never knew where they wanted you. Mostly we were sleeping in dispersals, saving trouble getting up and undressing and so on. We had my west on, just been waiting for a telephone call to take off. And sometimes we were in the air three times a day, four times a day. I had very little rest. You had all day, tiring day. When it's finished flying, you just washed and go to the pub for a drink. Next day, you never know, you not come back.
The pilot's combat reports, read for us by RAF pilots serving with the Red Arrows display team, and the stories of veterans, Leslie Gordon-Batt, Geoffrey Page, and Eugene Sharman, describe living through the thick of the battle. Carl Warner has read many similar accounts from that time.
What comes across in some of the personal accounts is that it feels very like a building catastrophe, like this relentless drive that the Luftwaffe is grinding the RAF down.
RAF fighter pilots did face terrible odds. During the course of the Battle of Britain, more than 500 pilots, one in six of them, were killed. But apart from the heavy loss of personnel and aircraft, the RAF commanders were also deeply concerned about the psychological burden of the battle. Dr. Lindsay Shaw Cobden is an historian of medicine and the Royal Air Force, who currently works for the RAF's Air Historical Branch. She says the impact on pilots was huge.
Many of them found it impossible to sleep, and others were just exhausted by the pace of the battle and the actual act of combat flying itself. Fatigue was believed to impair a pilot's ability to manage fear or calculate risk, and neuropsychiatrists believed that some of them got to this point and that they didn't even care if they lived or died. The RAF probably lost quite a few pilots because of this.
The head of fighter command, Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding, ordered the men to take 24 hours rest every week, and squadrons that had seen particularly heavy fighting to be moved to quieter parts of the country to recover. But these very young men, whose average age was just 20, still had to face the imminent threat of death. At RAF Duxford, an airbase in Cambridgeshire, the station chaplain Guy Mayfield kept a diary in a series of blue school books. In them, he recorded his experiences during the Battle of Britain and beyond. We're able to share some extracts from his diary with you, read by the actor Alistair Petrie.
Peter appeared with beer and questions following upon Trenchard's death. It was a relief to be able to talk realistically to him about the things which we keep concealed for the most part beneath the surface. What happens when you die? Is it wrong to be frightened of dying? How should you live if you are 20 and will be dead by the end of the summer?
Guy Mayfield's job was to care for the well-being of the men, pilots and ground crew alike, many of whom came to him with fears and problems they felt they couldn't share with anyone else. Carl Warner has studied his diary extensively.
So day-to-day life, as described by Mayfield, is pretty intense. If you imagine, it's a very strange way to fight a war. You know, you are getting called into the air for an hour at a time, maybe. You're fighting for your life, you're fighting for your country. And then a few hours later, you're having dinner in the mess, you're having drinks, you're maybe going on a date. The pilots pretty much are coming to him and saying, look, we know we're going to be dead before the end of the summer. And the problem is, you know, we've not done anything, you know, we haven't had sex. Really, really heart-wrenching stuff. Fundamentally, he's there for them and he sees his duty as kind of psychological care. And I think he was very successful at that.
The average age of RAF personnel, not simply aircrew, is 23. Certainly the first impression gained in the mess here is one of extreme youth. The pilot officers in particular look like schoolboys. One feels the temptation to tell them that they are staying up too late. The majority of the aircrew have yet to experience combat. What of the aircrew nerves when things hot up? How long will those who aren't killed survive mentally? Last night, the first fatal accident for 6 months took place here. The pilot, who was 19, was night flying solo and crashed on landing. He went straight into the ground. The plane exploded. There wasn't very much left of him. We saw the flames of the crash on leaving the camp cinema. Everyone knew the cause, but no comments were made and everyone went on as if nothing had happened. This is probably the right way to treat it all, but I would like to know what some of the trainees and instructors really think behind the mask of indifference.
The mask of indifference did sometimes slip. And as well as chaplains, on-base medical staff were advised to look out for signs of something wrong. The advice listed an array of warning signs, from weight loss to men indulging more than normal in alcohol or tobacco, to physical tremors, digestive trouble, insomnia, and sleepwalking. A medically induced rest was sometimes prescribed, but there were other common coping mechanisms, according to Dr. Lindsay Shaw Cobden.
Alcohol helped many men to sleep or to erase memories of the day's air fighting. It also stopped men from physically shaking. But it could be a problem, though. It's rumoured that on occasions, ground crews had to actually pour pilots into their cockpits in the morning and revive them with oxygen because they were still hammered from the night before. Superstition was another way of coping, and some of them genuinely believed that it saved them from death. Many men refused to say goodbye when parting company, as that could seal an individual's fate.
The men had other ways of blowing off steam. Sometimes, as veteran Leslie Gordon Batt recalls, dark humour helped them, even in the midst of battle.
I saw an aircraft, a 109, coming down vertically from above me. He was going at a rate of knots that was absolutely phenomenal. And suddenly his wings came off and the acceleration of the fuselage minus its wings must have made a hole in the channel, and I thought, well, that's saved someone digging a grave.
In Guy Mayfield's diary, there are similar stories of crews taking an almost perverse pleasure in talking about the horrors of the air war.
The talk in the mess this evening was about bailing out. It seems that even if your parachute doesn't open, you remain conscious till you make your hole in the ground. The station engineering officer told us of fingernails torn away in attempts to open the parachute somehow when the release device has failed, or the wearer has lost his head and can't find the press release.
Having seen the pilots in action during these intense days, the Prime Minister Winston Churchill spoke in Parliament on the 20th of August 1940. He paid tribute to the fighter pilots, referring to them as the few. It is the name by which they've been known ever since.
The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
As the Battle of Britain wore on, the Luftwaffe continued sending endless waves of bombers and fighters over Britain. From August to September 1940, Fighter Command lost 307 pilots, killed in flight training and combat, deemed as missing, or taken as prisoners of war. Fighter pilots were targets in the air and, along with their ground crews, at their bases too. They were put under intense strain for months. The support of medical officers and others, like Guy Mayfield, charged with the crew's pastoral care, was crucial in helping them to survive, both mentally and physically. While some efforts were made to curb the heaviest drinking.
At the station level, various changes were made in response to pilot feedback and medical advice. Tannoy messages were limited to operational instructions as the pilots were getting very frustrated when the message was about more routine station matters and not the order to scramble. Station recreations were also introduced to address the mass exodus of men to the pubs in the evenings who were coming back in a variety of states. The RAF didn't want to ban alcohol, but the station commander could control the hours that the bar was open and send pilots to bed, which was essential. Sports facilities were expanded or built to also give men an outlet for nervous energy.
Comradeship is really, really important because it enables men and women to do these sorts of things. But the effect when you lose somebody who you've come to regard as a brother, as a family member, is extra hard. The only common denominator, I guess, is loss on all sides.
After a short engagement, I saw Pilot Officer Cardell make for home. I followed him and observed him to be having difficulty with his aircraft. He bailed out at 500 feet, a quarter of a mile off Folkestone Beach, but his parachute failed to open. I circled for 10 minutes, and as no attempt had been made by the people on the beach to rescue Pilot Officer Cardell, I force landed on the beach, commandeered a rowing boat, and picked up Pilot Officer Cardell. He had, however, by this time, been drowned.
In August, we lost 5 out of 6. On one flight, they went off. Stuart Walsh was leading the flight, and somewhere over Swanage, I think it was. And out of the 6, only Irwin Mann, he was the only one to come back. And he said they were just suddenly attacked out of the blue by 109s, and they all went down. 5 out of 6.
That's veteran Brian Considine's story. And it's moments like this in the combat reports that convey the deep sadness of that loss, of life, of friendship, and of promise. You find them in Guy Mayfield's diary too.
The war, or the future of it, has got me down badly. I've been thinking over what Peter said to me yesterday after we had landed. I told him that other pilots think he's doing things in the air which are damn silly. He accepted it all and replied in a very depressed way, "What does it matter? I shall be killed anyway. If not killed, I shall be maimed. There won't be much left to live with and no job to go to after the end of the war." We talked and walked for a long time, very frankly and about many things with a directness that I never wanted to talk to any young man about. Hanging over everything is the threat of the ominous and immediate future. We both of us smelt death.
One of the greatest takeaways of something like that diary is that it gives them back their humanity. It shows them as human beings. It shows them as flawed, brilliant, inspirational, frustrating human beings like the rest of us. And that, in a sense, makes what they did even more extraordinary.
Though it didn't know it yet, Fighter Command was coming through the worst of the Battle of Britain. For the Luftwaffe, the worst was yet to come. But to the thousands of exhausted young RAF personnel in the skies and on the ground, it was just another day on the job. They had to be ready to scramble the next day, and the next day, and the day after that, never knowing when the end was in sight.
This podcast is brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the RAF's leading welfare charity. We are there for all members of the RAF family in their time of need, from those serving today to former members of the RAF, as well as their partners and dependent children. If you know of someone who might need some support, or to find out more, please visit our website, rafbf.org.
In the next episode, International Squadrons, we'll hear from some of the hundreds of men, both from the Commonwealth and occupied Europe, who rallied to Britain's side in her hour of need. Their contribution was crucial to the victory in the Battle of Britain.
I thought we found another home. We thought people want to fight. And the attitude of British people was so calm. And they were so friendly.
This is an RAF Benevolent Fund production by Chalk and Blade. It is co-written and presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Eva Krusiak, the mix and theme music are by Alex Port-Felix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeter and Logan Armandoni. Eugene Sharman's interview is courtesy of Derbyshire County Council, Buxton Museum and Art Gallery. Other oral history clips are courtesy of the Imperial War Museum. Recordings of Churchill's speeches are copyright of the BBC. And other original audio clips are courtesy of the BFI National Film Archive. The combat report extracts, which are held at the National Archives, were read by Red 5 Flight Lieutenant David Simmons and Red 10 Squadron Leader Adam Collins of the Red Arrows and Squadron Leader Mark Discombe, Officer Commanding of the Royal Air Force Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. The extracts from Guy Mayfield's diary are edited by Carl Warner and published by the Imperial War Museum in Life and Death in the Battle of Britain, The Diary of Guy Mayfield. They were read for us by Alistair Petrie, whose father was a fighter pilot who served in the RAF for more than 40 years. The historical consultant is Stuart Hadaway at the Royal Air Force Air Historical Branch.